If you think you can't go from politics to the divine, Carol Gold and Steve Clark are about to take you above the fray. The only agenda here is to empower you to think for yourself, ask more questions, and trust your own truth. So now, the combination talk radio has been missing. Until now, Carol Gold and Steve Clark taking you above the fray.
Hi, I'm Carol Gold, welcoming you here to Above the Fray. The call-in number is 914-803-4522. I think that's what it is. Wrong pair of glasses tonight. and I'm here with my co-host, Steve Clark. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Carol. How are you?
Good. I'm great. Steve, I know we're going to talk about leadership tonight on the show for a very specific reason, but I think actually a good way to get there, ultimately, probably wind up there last, the way to start, though, talking about leadership, you know, for the last several days, maybe a little longer, the media has been, you know, sort of obsessed with, as they do, they get on these rants with Hillary and her emails and what she did or did not turn over. But what's been almost completely ignored until the last few hours is the election tomorrow in Israel. It is an election to determine whether the Likud, the conservative right party led by Benjamin Netanyahu, whether he will stay as prime minister or whether the Zionist Union, which is the left, the Labor Party, will replace him. It's a complicated process in Israel. It's not a straight election the way we have it. There's all sorts of, and still not be able to put a government together. There are so many factions, and they have to be put together in a way where a majority rules, because there's no one party that has enough votes to actually maintain a majority in and of themselves. So there's always some form of negotiating that goes on afterward. But what I wanted to really stress here, Steve, is, you know, when Benjamin Netanyahu came here to speak before a joint session of Congress, President Obama did not attend, nor did Vice President Biden. And the reason given, allegedly, was that the president, our president, did not want to be seen influencing an election in a foreign country, given that it was 15 days before the Israeli election. It's very hard to take that seriously when Jeremy Byrd, who was a field director for Obama in his 2012 reelection campaign, went to Israel by way of One Voice. If you don't know One Voice, it's you can go to onevoicemovement.org. I don't know why you'd want to. It's actually it gets taxpayer money, that organization, and it is a alleged voice for mainstream Israelis and Palestinians. And the website actually says, when you open it up, the banner says, One Voice for Israel and Palestine. Well, there is no Palestine. And so they're obviously promoting a two-state solution, which in and of itself contradicts the subtext of that website, which says that it is for mainstream voices in both, quote, countries. Mainstream Israelis are not in favor of a two-state solution, and there is no Palestine. And so I don't know what mainstream living in the territories in Gaza and in the West Bank, I don't know what they think. But my point is that One Voice, which gets taxpayer dollars, U.S. taxpayer dollars, sent over Jeremy Byrd, who I said was a former Obama campaign field organizer, director actually, sent him there to oversee what's called V15, for Victory 15. It is an organization on the ground in Israel, a community organization, guess where they got their direction from, to topple Netanyahu. That is their stated goal, to topple Netanyahu. And so the president, who didn't want to give a foreign dignitary who is our greatest ally the grace of his presence for a speech to a joint session of Congress and most of the world that was watching, has no problem with his former field director going over to Israel to try to influence. And actually, if not equally, if not more offensive, is Paul Begala, who was one of the prime architects of Bill Clinton's political victories. Paul Begala is in Israel campaigning for the Zionist camp, which is the left-wing party that's trying to defeat Netanyahu. So it's so, I mean, I'm not naive enough to think that the United States has never been in foreign countries and that we've never impacted elections. But the brazenness, and I'll use the word chutzpah because it's a Jewish word, it's a Hebrew word, it means arrogance. The chutzpah of this administration and of the obvious left and Democrats to go over there. And in addition to that, what boggles my mind, Steve, because we're talking about leadership as an overall theme in a way, what boggles my mind is that so many Jewish Democrats here in the United States, liberal Democrats, have been funneling money to Israel to defeat Netanyahu. It's as if their obsession with their, it's as if their Democratic affiliation is their religion, not their Judaism or any allegiance or commitment or concern they may feel for Israel. Because Herzog, who's running against Israel, has made it very clear. He will divide Jerusalem. He will enter into a two-state solution. And he went so far recently as to say any deal that Obama cuts with Iran, he sure will be a good deal. So, you know, it seems to me that one of the few leaders on the world stage has been Benjamin Netanyahu, who came from pretty ordinary background, who served in the military, who lost his own brother in the raid in Entebbe. Two very honored men in the state of Israel, both Bibi and his brother Yoni, who died in that raid, came from modest upbringing. And I think that that's something that I know I'm covering a lot here, Steve, but I know the umbrella of what we wanted to talk about was leadership. And this is so much about leadership, and it's about good leadership, and it's about, as far as I'm concerned, bad leadership from President Obama, which is nothing new, but I think it's reached a level of incredulity. I almost can't believe how our president disregards our friends and our Constitution. Steve?
Yeah, I think the point that I would make is that I found fascinating is that the whole point of when Netanyahu came over here was the amount of influence that he was having in our country, that he was not specifically invited by the president, Congress had overrode the president by allowing him to speak, the how upset the media got over allowing a foreign leader to have so much influence in our politics. And you know, the flip side of the story, as you mentioned, was, well, they didn't mention anything about Obama's staff and Obama's cronies going over to Capitol in a direct election for the president. For the leadership post in Israel.
Prime Minister.
Netanyahu just came over here and gave a speech, kind of as an invited world leader, and gave a speech about what he thought was the crisis and what he thought was clearly something relevant to his country, which were the negotiations with Iran. Contrast to that, where Obama and his cronies are sending people over there directly influencing an election to remove him from his post, so that the Obama and what's called the leftists, the progressives, get the person that they want in power. But there is not a peep by the media on that double standard that exists. And the fact of the matter is, you're not going to hear it. And if you ask most people, they have no idea that this is going on. So I think, again, the media did a horrendous job of not reporting something that was clearly relevant to the story at hand.
Well, I think it's even more relevant than we're talking about at the moment. If you think about it, there's a foreign policy and a defense of the United States reason why we should be concerned about our president muddling. You know, he is trying to cut a deal with Iran that clearly the Senate and the Congress are very nervous about at the best. They're nervous about it. And I think it's because he's had virtually no successes in either administration. And he's looking to go out with a foreign policy, you know, slam dunk as he sees it, which would be some kind of nuclear agreement with Iran. But there are games being played here that are so much more intricate and involved than what it appears to be on its face. And so if he gets to do two things with opposing Netanyahu. He gets to be vindictive, which he is. He's petty and he's vindictive and he's childlike, this president. You know, when he said to LaRaza, when he was running the second time, that we should reward our friends and punish our enemies, when he said punish our enemies, he was referring at LaRaza to the Republicans. And so he has a mean streak in him and he has a vindictive streak in him. And so he hates Netanyahu, because Netanyahu would not bow to his Middle Eastern policy. From the day he came into office, Netanyahu has been a thorn in his side. He has disregarded and disrespected Netanyahu on every single U.S. visit that Netanyahu made during his two terms as president, Obama's two terms as president. And so his first payoff for what he's doing is he just gets to be the petty, vindictive person that he is, egoic, and needing to get even for not bowing at the feet of the anointed one. The second benefit he gets is, if he gets Herzog in, and he gets the left entrenched in Israel, then he plays more into the alliance and the allegiance, and I would call it the appeasement, that he's trying to do with the Arab world, and particularly with Iran. Because then there's no opposition in Israel, and then ISIS and ISIL and Al-Qaeda and whoever else, Iran, can storm their way, because the left will never adequately defend Israel the way the right will. It's just the way it is. And so while that looks bad enough, Steve, there's something else going on over there in Europe and in the Middle East and in Russia. And what's playing out is basically either Putin, or worse than Putin, actually. If something happens to Putin, I think whoever fills that void is worse than Putin, because that's who his opposition is now. The decent opposition he had, they executed last week. So now what's left are radicals that are more fascistic than he is. So, I mean, more communistic than he is. So what's happening is that he's talking about wanting to reestablish the Orthodox Church, the Roman army, as it were, the Roman Empire, the Third Roman Empire, by moving south and east, Crimea and the Ukraine, and then obviously down into Europe, because he's been funneling money and financing Europe for quite some time. But the money he's sending into Europe is funding and financing the fascists in Europe, because the fascists are now the only ones opposing the radical Muslims. So you've got fascism being funded by Putin communism for the purpose of opposing radical Islam, which wants the confrontation with whoever they can get it, because they believe washing the world in blood is their solution to bringing on the Mahdi and the worldwide caliphate, where Sharia rule will dominate the world. And it's like watching a train wreck. It's like watching two trains driving toward each other, because what Obama's doing is he's facilitating all of that from happening. His presidency has removed the barriers that have existed for a very long time to holding communism and fascism and all kinds of extremism in check. He's removed those barriers and he's created like an open playing field, and he's rushing, you know, his rush to judgment before he leaves office is to try to make all this happen. And when all of this, quote, happens, what we're going to find ourselves deep in is World War III.
Yeah, it was an article in the Post this weekend that kind of spurred this conversation, was that
What post?
The Post came out.
The
New York Post came out with an article this week, and they said, "Why is the U.S. and Europe basically having such a hard time in the world right now?" And basically, the premise of the article was that the U.S. has, and for the most part, European leaders are educated in the best schools and educated in a train of thought that kind of is a systematic. You go to the best schools. You go to the State Department, you work your way up to the political ladder, and that's how policy is set in the world. Well, the reality is policy is not, you know, that's how we set policy in the world. But if you look at some of the leaders over the last 100 years, you know, Hitler was a corporal in the army. Ho Chi Minh was living in France and working in a restaurant. I mean, Putin was a low-level player on the Russian scene, and he was able to work his way up and control the country. Now, if you look at the way our political leaders are born and bred, they're born here in the U.S. and they go to certain schools and they get a certain mindset, and that's how they deal with the world. And the reality is how the world reacts to power and how we try to influence power are two different things. And I think the world and some of the more volatile places are really, you know, it's much more ruthless. They're much more willing to kill. They're much more willing to do things that we in the West are unwilling to do. And so, hence, we're negotiating at a huge disadvantage with these people. It reminds me of the story, Carol, that in about, I don't know, 20 years ago, the CIA, it was almost virtually impossible to get into the CIA at one point because they just wanted the cleanest people and the most clean-cut people. And what they ended up doing is they hired a bunch of Mormons. And it was an absolute disaster. And the reason why it was a disaster is that, you know, to catch a criminal, you need a criminal. There's something about the criminal mind and the way that it works that it's important to have and have those people how they think. And so they kind of abandoned that strategy, and, you know, they went after people that had criminal elements to them. And the fact is that I don't really have a problem with that. There's people that have done crimes and have done bad things in life, and they convert and they repent and they try to get back on the right side of the law, and those people can be invaluable assets. But to discount them and disregard them and their views as being criminal in nature, I think is a very silly, you know, mindset. And that's kind of the way that I look at the U.S. policy. They're dealing, you know, it's kind of they're dealing with our enemies are playing kind of a three-dimensional chess game, while we in the West are playing essentially checkers on a level board and not understanding why our enemies are doing certain things that they're doing.
Well, you make a good point about, you know, it takes a criminal to catch a criminal. That's actually it's probably the strongest argument for why Netanyahu should stay prime minister of Israel. He has spent his entire life, and you know, it's not just Israel. When he comes here, as he did before Congress, and he spoke about the Arab mindset and the way that Iran is approaching things and the naivete of thinking you can cut a deal with them that they will honor, not understanding that there is no honor in the Arab world, that lying to advance Sharia, to advance Islam, is an attribute of the religion. When he does that, he should be given so much credibility because he has not only lived in the region, grown up in the region, he's fought in the region. He knows the mindset. And so to make light or little of what he comes to tell us at a critical time in history is really to look a gift horse in the mouth. The other thing that you said, Steve, that prompted something in my mind, again, about it takes a criminal to catch a criminal. I heard recently, just today in fact, that because I wanted to talk a bit about Ferguson and the agitation there, and what I heard was that it was from a guy who tracks origins of trails on the internet. In other words, if there's a story trending, he has the ability, the skill, to go back and back and back and find out where these things start. Because sometimes, you know, people are manipulated through what is put out through social media, but he has this ability, his company, to go back to origins of threads or origins of Twitter feeds or whatever it is. So he was analyzing actually Ferguson, and he made the point at the end of the analysis, and I'll go there in a minute, but the point he made was we should not be worried about radical Islamists crossing the southern border. We should be much more worried about what's happening in our prisons, because in our prisons there is a mass conversion to radical Islam. to basically engaging them in the fight, in jihad. And these are dangerous people. These are people that have been locked away for a reason. And even those who might be wrongly locked away or locked away for a lesser reason, a prison environment can turn someone even further down the path of crime and more vengeful and more hateful of a white society that put them there. And so he said there is a real problem in radicalizing prisoners. What I wanted to say, and if you have some, did you have something you want to say about that, Steve, before I just actually turn it into Ferguson?
No, go ahead.
He was saying that in Ferguson, he drew, I watched him draw this connector, these dots and lines that connected one thing to the other. And it seems like the fomenting in Ferguson appeared on social media and in media appears to be a confluence of the Reverend Al Sharpton's something about United America, I forget the name of his organization. His organization, Louis Farrakhan, SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, which did Obama's dirty work, actually providing the buses, Al Sharpton generating the cause, and Farrakhan providing the bodies to get on the buses, actually bringing in people to foment. And according to this guy, he's been able to track $33 million that's gone into Ferguson directly from George Soros' organizations. And so there is this shooting of these two cops, which, by the way, is now being called by those on the left, it's being called a setup, that it was really the KKK that shot these cops that were out to shoot black people, that there is a setup in Ferguson, which is just a mini version of what's happening in other cities, which is the effort to polarize communities and to turn the black civilian population against the police departments, so that essentially there will ultimately be the need for either martial law or we'll find ourselves in some kind of a civil war. But his connections, in including reporters that are pro-Palestinian reporters that are in Ferguson or have been and are sharing, they're sharing between the territories in Israel and the fomenting within our inner cities techniques and methods. So from the territories in Israel to here, they're sharing how they've been able to destabilize the Israeli situation and how they use violence to incite. From here to the territories, they're coming here to learn from these organizations like Farrakhan's and Sharpton. They're coming here to learn how to basically community organize and to use social media to create unrest. This is stunning, and I think 90% of this country is still asleep.
Oh, they're completely asleep. I don't think they fully understand the intentions of what they're trying to do here. I think the narrative that they're portraying is that it's just, you know, Ferguson people are rioting over this killing of a policeman. And I'm sorry, the policeman killing the person in Ferguson. And I think that's just the opposite. I think it was a tragedy that unfolded. But what's, you know, like you said before, and you've laid it out in detail, there's no doubt in my mind that there are people coming into that area to agitate the situation. And I think what the left is trying to do is create a bigger movement of more instability. I think, you know, we've talked about this at length in the show. The ultimate goal for anybody in power is more power, and to the extent that they can cause more unrest and get more of these riots taking place more on a national level, it gives the opportunity for the police and it gives the opportunity for local governments to seize more power and more power. I mean, let's call it what it is. The power that's really going to be encroached on is the people who generally love freedom. And to the extent that they can, you know, the politicians can grab more power, they're going to do so. And I think also what I think there's an element that's happening here is that to the extent that people who are afraid, let's call it what, the middle class that are afraid of these rights coming to their house, they're going to be happy to secede this power. You know, Carol, I don't know if you remember, but in the Boston bombing a couple of years ago, they shut down the whole city. I mean, they literally shut down the whole city, and police went, you know, door-to-door, armed guards, I mean, armed police fully loaded to the hilt, you know, basically
right. They were in riot gear. I remember those photos. Those images are blazoned in my mind. They had tanks, and they were in riot gear.
And they basically shut down the whole city. And let's call it what it is. They went after two people, as horrendous as they act as they did. But everybody else was, you know, they were prisoners in their own homes during that time period. So I think it's a very deadly trade-off to say that, you know, to catch these guys, everybody else is going to get, has to stay in their house and loses their freedoms as well. And I think that's the essential goal behind Ferguson, you know, a grabbing or seizing as much power as possible.
I don't know if you saw President Obama last week, but I watched him. I don't think it was a presser. I think it was, I forget why he was speaking, but he said, in order to gain security, in order to be safe, you have to give up some liberty.
I did not see that.
Huh?
I did not see that.
Yes, and I thought to myself, no. You sacrifice safety for liberty. You don't trade off liberty for safety. That's backwards. But, of course, the way he presented it, it sounds so reasonable because he was saying, you know, people are worried about their privacy and drones and the NSA and wiretapping and capturing of emails and yada, yada, yada. But he was making the point that you have to give up a little bit of liberty in order to be safe. What a dangerous comment and a dangerous concept, but you know, it's a slippery slope. How many people just heard that and bought it? Because they're already conditioned. They've already given up liberty. They've already accepted the fact that there's no privacy. They've always already accepted the fact that there's, you know, you actually have to put your iPhone in a drawer and close it at night in your bedroom if you want to be certain no one will be watching you in that bedroom. I mean, that's literally what you have to do because there's a camera and there's a microphone, and whether you have that phone on or off, they have the capacity to access your habitat. So people have just begun to live with it, and it is a danger. It is such a danger because, like with the election in Israel tomorrow, you know, I posted to a blog site, I posted a comment to a blog, and I said, I hope the Israelis wake up before, not after tomorrow, the way we are, some of us have awakened after 2008 and after 2012, and people are still awakening to the dangerous person that we put in charge of the most powerful office in the world. And I've said it before, he's not done, and we're not done unmasking him. Before he leaves that office, we will know who he really is, and we will rue the day anyone ever walked into a voting booth and voted for him. Steve, we got a minute and a half. You want to say something?
No, I think we've covered the topic at length here.
Okay, well, I wanted to talk a bit about ISIS and the Levant, ISIL, and actually Pope Clement V. But since I can't possibly do that in 90 seconds, then that's what we're going to talk about when we open the show on Thursday night. I think it's important for everyone to understand why ISIS just printed over the weekend and published on the internet that they're going to attack France and England. If you know your history, you'll understand what that's all about. So I'm Carol Gold. I'm here with my co-host. Go ahead, Steve, sign out.
Steve Clark.
And this has been Above the Fray. Please spread the word. We try to bring you truth as we perceive it. We try to bring you intelligent thought as we are able to communicate it. And we try to bring you reasons for thinking for yourself and not allowing us or anyone else to tell you what's true for you. Be back again Thursday night, 6 p.m., Above the Fray. Have a great week, everybody.
You've been listening to Above the Fray with Carol Gold and Steve Clark, from politics to the divine. Thanks for being a part of a new way to see the world. Visit our website at AboveTheFrayPodcast.com and like us on our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/AboveTheFrayPodcast. This has been Carol Gold and Steve Clark, taking you always above the fray.